Thanks. So yeah, today, as David said, I'd like to give you a very experimental sort of flavor for some of the manipulation and measurement of nuclear spins that we've done in our in David's lab over the past several years. I just finished up my PhD, so this will be sort of an abbreviated version of my defense, as well as I'll also talk a little bit about some work that Martino Poggio, former student and now postdoc at IBM, worked on. But the bulk of my talk will be focused on sort of 2D imaging of electron spin and nuclear spin. So these are lateral images of, in this case, electron spin and gallium arsenide, endoped gallium arsenide, and nuclear spin polarization and gallium arsenide in the same sample. So yeah, the first part of my talk, I'm going to focus on what has been called the ferromagnetic imprinting effect and the proximity polarization of electron spins. So this is sort of the nuclear spin side of things, and this is sort of the explanation for the underlying electron spin that drives this nuclear spin. And then the second part, if there's time, and briefly, I'll just touch on what Martino worked on in some two-dimensional quantum well structures for ways in which he was able to electrically manipulate nuclear spins on sort of nanometer scales. And so just for the first part of my talk, I'm going to talk about sort of a little bit of the background experiments for these two effects, and then I'm going to talk about three further experiments where, in the first case, we actually generate electron spin all electrically, which, if we choose to, can also be used to drive large nuclear spin polarizations in gallium arsenide. And in the second two portions of this first part of the talk, I'll be focusing more on the nuclear spin polarization rather than the electron spin polarization. And these polarizations are not electrically driven, but rather optically or magnetically driven. In all these cases, these are lateral top-down images, in this case of electron or nuclear spin, with sort of micron-type resolution. And I'll describe how we're able to measure that. So I just wanted to spend one slide talking about our measurement technique that is a real workhorse in our lab. I'm sure many of you have seen this before, but I'll go briefly into it. So this is called the time-resolved Kerr rotation measurement, and we use this as a means for nuclear magnetometry. And in this experiment, we have an ultrafast titanium sapphire laser, and we split the output into two beams, a pump beam, which is circularly polarized, and a probe beam, which is linearly polarized. And we can separate these in time also with a mechanical delay line. So what we do is we reflect this pump beam off the sample, off the gallium arsenide sample, or AlGaAs sample as it may be, and due to the convenient selection rules present in these zinc blend semiconductors, and in order to conserve the angular momentum associated with this pump beam, as some of this pump beam is absorbed by the sample, you create spin-polarized electrons and holes. We're going to just disregard the hole spin for the most part in this talk because they decohere very rapidly and aren't part of the picture that I'll be talking about. So in any case, we create this spin-polarized puddle of electrons, we'll say at time equals zero, in the direction of this optical path, so perpendicular to the sample face here. And if you apply a transverse magnetic field, these electron spins will start precessing at the Larmor frequency, semi-classically. Now, if we want to measure what these spins are doing, measure their precession frequency and their decoherence time, we can reflect this probe beam, which is linearly polarized off the sample, right where those spins were created, and then measure the rotation of this linearly polarization axis, theta sub k, as a function of this time, which is nanoseconds or less, roughly, between the pump and the probe pulses. Now, as these electrons are precessing, they're going to have a net magnetization along this optical path that's going to switch. It's going to change with time in this sort of cosinusoidal manner. And this, it turns out this rotation angle due to the Kerr effect is proportional to the magnetization in this x direction in this case, in this perpendicular to the sample direction. So as they precess, you sort of sweep out this precession, and you see this nice cosine, decaying cosine. And the decay can often just be fit with one sort of spin lifetime number, this T2 star transverse spin lifetime number. Now, if you fit this data, which we can do fairly easily, and then figure out what this new sub-L, this Larmor precession frequency is, we know that it's proportional to this term here, which is the applied magnetic field, and also this B subnuclear, which could also be any additional effective magnetic field that the electrons feel. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. But we know all these other constants. We know the G factor, we know mu B, we know H, and we know what our applied field is. So if we measure mu L, we have a nice measurement of any other effective magnetic field that these precessing electrons feel. And so because this nuclear effective field is proportional to the hyperfine coupling and the spin nuclear spin polarization, and this quantity A over G mu B is known roughly for gallium arsenide, finally this Larmor precession frequency acts as a magnetometer of the nuclear spin polarization. So in the ferromagnetic imprinting process, Roland Kawakami and others, former postdoc in the group, looked at several different materials that were composed generally of gallium arsenide with integrated with a ferromagnetic layer. This could be a single half monolayer of manganese arsenide, multiple half monolayers of manganese arsenide, random alloy, a ferromagnetic semiconductor, gallium manganese arsenide, or even manganese arsenide, which is a ferromagnetic metal grown on top of an optically active and doped gallium arsenide layer here. And basically, they popped these samples in the cryostat, cooled them down, did this time resolved, actually in this these experiments, Faraday rotation, so it's a transmission experiment, very similar to what I just explained, and just looked for what the Larmor precession frequency is for a known applied field. And here's the initial results. So for a control sample, you see sort of this relatively slow precession frequency. But for each of the ferromagnetic samples, you see that this precession frequency is noticeably faster. And in the case of the manganese arsenide, it's much, much faster. And if you just use this simple expression that I mentioned on the previous page to pull out this extra effective field that these precessing electrons are feeling, you see that for the case of the manganese arsenide grown on gallium arsenide, these precessing electrons in the gallium arsenide are acting like they're precessing with an applied field as high as in this case, 1.1 tesla. So that means there's an additional effective field of about a tesla for an applied field of only 1/10 of a tesla. So they, of course, wanted to figure out where this additional field was coming from, so there was a series of tests that they performed. The first was to look and see whether there was a connection or what the connection was exactly between the ferromagnet and the underlying semiconductor. So here's a static Mohs signal. So this is just a standard hysteresis curve, which tells you the magnetization versus applied field, and you see a nice square loop for this sample, which was composed of manganese arsenide and gallium arsenide. Now, if you look at the field dependence of the time-resolved Faraday rotation signal, this is the data shown here. So now the time scans go in the vertical direction, and this color scale tells you what the time-resolved Faraday rotation signal is. So you can see this again, oscillatory behavior as you take line cuts up here. Now, as you sweep the field, you might expect that if this effect is directly related to only the ferromagnetic layer, that you would see some behavior that is something like this square hysteresis loop. But as you can see, out here at a negative applied field, you have a relatively high precession frequency. As you decrease the applied field, the frequency slows, as you would expect. But around zero field, you see this dramatic change to actually, as far as we can resolve, almost no precession. So even though the ferromagnet is still magnetized fully at this state, this zero field state, we're seeing no spin precession. And so this was the first hint that it's not a 100% direct connection between the ferromagnet and ferromagnetic magnetization and the precessing spins and the effective additional field that's on them. And you can fit these data fit these time resolved Faraday rotation data and end up getting curves like this. And you see this marked difference between these two sets of data. So this basically ruled out the possibility, to a large extent, of the effect being due to fringing fields or direct exchange or something like that between the carriers and the gallium arsenide and the epitaxial ferromagnet, which is grown on top. The next check was to look at the lab time dependence in this experiment of the nuclear polarization. So here we start off in this left-hand state where the magnetization and the nuclear polarization, as I'm getting to, are aligned, and then the field, the applied field, was set just below the coercive field. So the magnetization is still to the left, but we're about to switch the field when we get to this 1,000 or 0.1 Tesla range, and so we monitor the Larmor precession frequency, and then we switch, increase the field a little bit, switch the magnetization to the right, and observe that the Larmor frequency changes. And this change takes a long time, on the order of 20 minutes or so, until we end up in this right-hand state where, once again, the magnetization and the nuclear spins are polarized in the same direction. Let's see. So this was another hint, or this was a hint that the nuclei could be involved, because the T1 times for nuclei in solid-state systems are known to be very long, on the order of these real lab time, minute time scales. And then the real proof, without any doubt, was to do this all optical nuclear magnetic resonance experiment. So in this experiment, I don't want to go into too much detail, but they used a photoelastic modulator to switch the circular polarization of the pump beam between left and right-handed polarization at some frequency, some kilohertz frequency, and then swept the applied magnetic field at a fixed delay, and then just monitored the Faraday rotation signal as a function of this changing applied field. And what they see are these nice resonances that can be fit very well with this resonance condition where this is a gyromagnetic ratio of an individual nuclear species, and F is the PEM frequency and B is the applied field. So for each of these peaks, they could assign a specific nuclear isotope in the sample. So this was really 100% proof that in the ferromagnetic imprinting process, nuclear spins in the gallium arsenide were being spin polarized. So the last hint in this in the ferromagnetic imprinting experiment came from this final experiment, where now instead of using a circularly polarized pump beam, they changed to using a linearly polarized pump beam. And in this case, you should not generate any optically generated electron spin in the gallium arsenide. But what they saw is that in this particular geometry, where the applied field is perpendicular to the magnetization of the manganese arsenide in this case, that you still generate these coherently precessing electron spins, despite the fact that they weren't created optically. So this pointed to the fact that the electron spins are involved in this process and may be the underlying cause for generating the nuclear spins, spin polarization. Now, the next experiment by Ryan Epstein, who just graduated recently from our group, was what elucidated this process, and he called it the ferromagnetic proximity polarization effect. And I don't want to go into too much detail here, but he used some clever geometry in the fact that the manganese arsenide magnetization tends to stay aligned both in, it doesn't tend to pull out of the plane if you have an applied field that has some component out of plane, and also won't rotate in the plane because of the large magnetocrystalline anisotropy. And so he used this to perform this experiment where he tilted the sample with respect to the applied magnetic field, and once again looked at the difference between using a circularly polarized pump beam and a linearly polarized pump beam for two different materials. In the left-hand side here, it's the manganese arsenide samples that I've been talking about, and he also looked at iron on gallium arsenide, which grows epitaxially as well. And again, what you see for the circularly polarized pump is what you would expect, but again, similarly to the hint that I just talked about in the ferromagnetic imprinting experiment, for a linearly polarized pump, in both cases, you once again see these coherent oscillations. And he was able to show that without a doubt that electron spins are becoming spin polarized either parallel or anti-parallel to this magnetization direction. And one of the interesting things from this paper is that for these two material systems, it looks like the electron spins become polarized in opposite directions. So in the case of the manganese arsenide, they are polarized, for instance, parallel to the magnetization, whereas for the iron, they're polarized anti-parallel to the magnetization.
And so what is the polarization depth?
You couldn't tell from this experiment exactly. This is all optical experiment. But in the next experiment, I'll talk about that briefly, and I can give you some guess, basically. Oh, so the point is that it looks like it's possible that the difference in the spin split energy bands, or the exact interfacial nature of the spin split energy bands in the ferromagnet grown epitaxial in the semiconductor, is having an effect on which way the electron spins are polarized. But I also point out that this is a fairly non-equilibrium process where you have a blast of light hitting the sample and lots of dynamics going on. So to come back to your question, this final sort of introductory experiment I wanted to mention was again done by Ryan Epstein, and he showed that this nuclear spin polarization could be gated in a sense electrically. And so in this sample here, we once again have N-doped gallium arsenide with a manganese arsenide ferromagnetic epilayer, and then he put these relatively large gates on the system and could drive current through the gallium arsenide and the manganese arsenide and out. And what he saw was that at zero applied bias, we see some precession frequency that has some nuclear spin component to it. But then as a function of applied voltage for these forward bias cases, we could increase this precession frequency fairly markedly with just a volt of applied voltage. And in the case of, again, an iron gallium arsenide sample, because of the opposite way the electron spins are polarized as compared to this material system, for negative applied biases, even though you have an applied magnetic field of 1 kilogauss, you can actually turn off the electron spin precession at this minus 1.7 volt. And then you could tune it to quite a high frequency. And at this voltage, actually, the effective nuclear spin polarization is on the order of 30%. So this is a very large effect. And one last note from this experiment. He basically was able to, Ryan showed very nicely that there was a close connection between the Schottky barrier that naturally forms at this interface between the metallic ferromagnet and the doped gallium arsenide, and the turn on of the nuclear spin polarization. So, for instance, here we have just IV curves for different applied optical powers, and you see that for no laser, you get a relatively sharp turn on at some bias voltage down here of a half volt or so. But then as you increase the optical power and you generate more photoexcited carriers in the system, you get this more gradual turn on that starts at lower applied voltage. And then if you look at this this total field, which has this nuclear component in it, you see that this turn on occurs right when the diode turns on. The diode starts, current starts flowing in the diode. So at roughly flat band conditions down here is when you're able to generate the electron or the nuclear spin polarization. So this red curve matches up with this power, this red power, and the blue matches up with the blue. So there's a very close connection between the energy band lineup and the turn on of the nuclear spin polarization. So this alludes to the fact that this interaction between the carriers in the semiconductor and the ferromagnet happens on a fairly short scale. So in this case, they're pushed away from the interface, and the wave function presumably does not penetrate near or into the ferromagnet at all, and the electron spins are no longer polarized. But when you get to flat band condition, they can spread out and interact with the ferromagnet. And these samples were all, 250 nanometers thick or so, and you have some depletion, so at the most, you're limited by the sample thickness of on the order of 100 nanometers, but it's probably even thinner than that. But it's hard to say exactly for sure. So the picture that emerged is that is as follows. So there's a coupling between the ferromagnet, electron, and nuclear spin systems. So you can think of this and break it up into two steps, sort of. You've got the spontaneous generation of electron spin polarization, even if you don't optically generate any electron spins. And these electron spins, in proximity with a ferromagnet, scatter or tunnel or interact somehow with this ferromagnet to become polarized, spin polarized along the direction of the magnetization or anti-parallel to it. In the second step, it's this the transfer of angular momentum angular momentum is transferred from the electron spin system to the nuclear spin system, and this is the well-known Oberhauser effect and ends up dynamically polarizing the nuclear spin system by these spin flip-flop type processes. And then finally, you end up with some relatively high, in some cases, nuclear spin polarization that then has this back action of an effective magnetic field on the precessing spins. So there are two sort of groups of electron spins to keep in mind here, the ones that become polarized along the magnetization and the ones that are still precessing that we're measuring in these experiments. So now I want to shift gears and talk about a few of my experiments where in this first case, I look to take this electrical gating experiment and take it to the logical conclusion, which is to use this ferromagnetic proximity effect, proximity polarization effect, to fully electrically generate electron spins in semiconductors. So in the previous experiments, they always required optical excitation in order to turn this interaction on. And Ryan showed that you could help this process out by applying a bias, but the optical excitation was still necessary. So in this series of experiments, I want to talk about just doing this fully electrically, still detecting the electron spin in an optical manner, but the generation is fully electrical. So this the motivation behind this, I don't need to spend too much time on it, I don't think, to this audience, but one of the main ingredients for spintronics is, of course, to be able to readily generate electron spin polarization or free carrier spin in semiconductors. And so lots of work has gone into systems like this where you have a ferromagnetic metal on a semiconductor, but you reverse bias it and move the naturally spin polarized carriers out of the ferromagnet through this tunneling barrier into the semiconductor. In this experiment, we actually turn the voltage on in the opposite direction and forward bias the system. And in this case, we're pulling carriers out of the semiconductor and into the ferromagnet. And so here's sort of a cross-section cartoon view of our sample. We've got contacts, we've got our manganese arsenide film, gallium arsenide epilayer, and we're going to run this in forward bias and look at what happens. So just to remind you, we're going to use time-resolved curve rotation once again as a nuclear magnetometer. And in order to measure the electron spin polarization, we use a different measurement in the same cryostat, same setup, but it's actually an easier, in a sense, measurement because we're just going to do this, what we called Hanley-Mok experiment. In this case, we just come in and reflect a linearly polarized beam off the sample, once again use the Kerr effect to and measure this Kerr rotation angle. And in this case, we're going to generate electron spins with some electrical pulse at some kilohertz frequency and apply a small field transverse to these spins, which are initially pointed perpendicular up in this case. And we're just going to measure get a measure using this of the time averaged electron spin. So this is very similar to the Hanley, the classic Hanley experiment, except we're not using photoluminescence as our measurement. We're using the Kerr effect, like the optic Kerr effect, to measure. And it turns out that you can go through some simple math and see that the spin polar time average spin can be fit, or this signal can be fit with this equation very nicely, and you can pull out this spin polarization rate A, the spin coherence time, or 1 over tau, which is spin depolarization rate, and this multiply them together and you get some approximation of the time averaged electron spin in the system from this fit. And I should point out that in these two experiments, the sample needs to be rotated 90 degrees from one another. So in the previous experiment, the applied field is parallel to the magnetization, but in this case, it's perpendicular. So one of the technical advances we made, Roland Kalankami and I made, was to construct this time-resolved Kerr microscope. And here's a close-up picture of our cryostat. So we have a little flow cryostat here. You can see the copper-cold finger, just an edge of the sample right here. And here's the scale for you. And basically what we do is we send the pump and the probe pulses, or just the probe in the case of the electron spin measurement, through this large numerical aperture, super long working distance microscope objective right here. And this focuses both the pump and the probe beams onto the surface down to about 1 micron type spot sizes. So this system allows us to reach temperatures between 5 and 300 Kelvin. We have an electromagnet here, which gives us relatively modest fields up to about a quarter Tesla. Like I said, about a micron resolution. And then we can step this microscope objective around. It's on a 3D stage in very small steps. And this compares to sort of the conventional measurements that I was talking about earlier in the ferromagnetic imprinting work, where the pump and the probe beams are generally fixed, so you don't move them around the sample. You can, but you can play some tricks to do that. And also, they're focused down. You don't have to work too hard to get a focus of about 40 microns. You can do a little bit better than that with better lenses and such, but we get at least an order of magnitude better optical resolution, and we're able to move very conveniently these pump and probe beams around on our sample in structures that we might want to etch. So here's a structure that we did etch. This is a top-down optical micrograph. So this bright stuff is gold contacts. This darker gray is the N-doped gallium arsenide. Underneath this is some insulating algas layer. And this lighter gray is a 50 by 100 micron type mesa of manganese arsenide. And what we're going to do is we're going to use our microscope to scan around laterally in a two-dimensional, if we want to, manner, and probe both the electron and nuclear spin polarization underneath and nearby this ferromagnetic contact.
What's the length scale there?
This is 50 microns wide and 100 microns long. So 100 microns this way also. And so here's the result. If we do the electron polarization measurement, the Hanley-Moak measurement, and image in two dimensions, the two lateral dimensions, we see that in the corners of this, underneath the corners of this ferromagnetic contact, so this is in the gallium arsenide again, we see a relatively high concentration of time-averaged electron spin near these corners. And if we flip the sample around, cool it down, do the same measurement with the applied field parallel to the magnetization, we again get the nuclear dynamic nuclear polarization measurement. And we see that there's a good correlation between these two scans here and here. But there is some smearing in the dynamic nuclear polarization measurement. We think that at least some of this smearing is due to the fact that in this measurement, the electron's coherence time is of the proper one to think about is a transverse T2 time, whereas in this case, it's the longitudinal T1 time, which can be longer, or is known to be longer in gallium arsenide. And so we can do, for the rest of these experiments, to save time, we just do, we perform line cuts like this for the nuclear and electron spin polarization. And here's again the side view of the device and a line cut of the electron spin polarization. And you can see that it's peaked right near the leading edge of the ferromagnet. And the same is true, although with some more spreading in the nuclear spin polarization. So we can look at the bias. We looked at the bias and temperature dependence. So here's for different biases. We see these line cuts as you ink. Let's see. Sorry, this is the temperature dependence up here, and this is the bias dependence down here. And you see as you increase the temperature. This is the bias dependence for the nuclear and the electron spins. And we see that as you increase the applied forward bias, you increase the nuclear polarization up to some point, but at this highest voltage, it's actually begun to decrease. And so we can plot these peak positions here along with the current voltage sweep, and we see that this non-monotonic behavior, this is probably due at least partly to ohmic heating in the sample, to the higher currents. Whereas for the electron spin polarization, we see monotonic increase with increasing bias and current of the time average electron spin. And as a function of temperature, we see this gradual decay to about zero by 60 Kelvin of the nuclear spin polarization, whereas the electron spin polarization falls off more gradually. And this this temperature behavior of the nuclear spins has been observed before. Well known. So we can separate the polarization rates A and the depolarization rates 1 over tau, and again, image across that line scan, and we see that for the polarization rate, as a function of bias, we see it's peaked at the front again and increases with applied bias. And the depolarization rate is also higher for the highest bias case and peaked near the leading edge. Now, as a function of temperature, we see that the polarization rate falls as expected as you reach 50 Kelvin, and the depolarization rate also increases as you get to higher temperatures. But it's relatively temperature independent near the leading edge of the sample. And so we think that this depolarization rate near the leading edge is at least to a large extent determined by the fact that you're moving the spins away. They're drifting in your applied field, and so they're not staying stationary there. And so the conclusions are we've demonstrated a new means that's all electrical for generating electron spin polarization in semiconductors. We pull out carriers from the semiconductor in some spin-dependent way, leaving behind spin-polarized carriers in the semiconductor. I didn't focus on this too much. I'll talk about this more in the next couple experiments, but we are able to reach effective nuclear fields up to about a half Tesla in these devices, and relatively large field gradients, 10 to the fifth Teslas per meter, just with a small DC applied bias. Some sort of qualitative theoretical work with Lu Sham and his previous student Jim McGuire suggested that the electron spin polarization is on the order of several percent, but we don't have a real hard number for that. And I think that, just wanted to point out that the microscopy techniques that we employ here serve as a useful probe for the spin polarization, both nuclear and electron, in many different lateral spintronics devices. And this has been the same microscopy technique has been used in to measure the spin hall, observe the spin hall effect, and other things. So it's a useful instrument. So now I want to shift gears and talk about rather than electrically generating electron spins, I want to talk about two different ways to pattern the nuclear spin laterally in the semiconductor. In this first case, I'm going to talk about just lithographically patterning the ferromagnet on the sample. And in the second case, I'll talk about just using purely optical means to generate laterally inhomogeneous nuclear spin polarizations. So I won't talk about the motivation too much here and just jump right into it, I guess. So the experiment basically is as follows. We took a very similar sample, so this is a top-down view where this is N-doped gallium arsenide underneath, and these are manganese arsenide, layers of manganese arsenide, thin layers either 15 or 25 nanometers thick that we've etched into these relatively large squares. We see that we still have nice magnetic properties for these process samples, and that at room temperature, magnetic force microscopy shows that these are composed of single magnetic domains. You can see this contrast difference in the left and right hand edges of one of these mesas. And the experiment is to, again, use a microscope. We have these etched mesas. And then we introduce this additional optical beam above band gap, above gallium arsenide band gap, and we defocus this CW diode laser beam to something like a millimeter diameter. And this gives us a broad, slowly varying optical illumination over the area of interest that we're going to be scanning and looking under these mesas for nuclear spin polarization. And so here are some results. So here's here's a CCD image, which shows one of these maces here. Here's the small pump and probe beams, and this broad light in the background comes from that imprinting beam. And so we're going to stop the pump and probe beam at one position, run a time-resolved curve rotation scan, move it over, repeat, and then we're going to fit the Larmor frequency. So we see that underneath the magnetic mesa, we see this high, relatively high precession frequency as you would expect, and that as you move off into the area where there's no ferromagnet above the gallium arsenide, we see this decrease in the Larmor frequency. And you can fit this, you can plot this Larmor frequency versus position. And I'll come back to that in a second. And you can also, of course, run the 2D, get the 2D images of the nuclear spin polarization. So in this case, the gallium arsenide underneath the ferromagnet was 500 nanometers thick. But we also looked at, and we can fit this data, these line cuts again. But we also looked at thinner samples, in this case 100 nanometers thick gallium arsenide, and we see some qualitative differences in these two images. We see that there's a lot more sort of inhomogeneity in the nuclear spin polarization, and this transition from high nuclear polarization to low nuclear polarization outside of the mesa is much sharper in this case. And we define this parameter lambda, which gives you some measure of the width of this transition. And we can, of course, use this to pattern other more complex shapes if we want to. Although this lambda is going to set how precisely you can tailor the nuclear polarization. So we looked at the dependence of this width lambda on the gallium arsenide epilayer thickness, as well as some measure of that lateral inhomogeneity, the average divided, or the standard deviation divided by the mean nuclear polarization under the mesa. And we see that as you saw by eye in the previous pictures, as you increase the gallium arsenide thickness, this width lambda increases, whereas the inhomogeneity decreases. And we note that we also measured an iron sample, an iron grown on gallium arsenide sample, which has lower strain than the manganese arsenide, and we see much lower inhomogeneity. So this might point to the role that the different strain, interfacial strain plays in this process. We also looked at the electrical properties of the doped gallium arsenide under illumination. And so if we just look at the mobility versus temperature, we see an increase from 5 to 30 Kelvin, whereas this width lambda, this transition width in the nuclear polarization lambda is relatively flat. And you can fit these line cuts, which I showed before, with a simple steady-state diffusion model and pull out the diffusion time, which may or may not be related to the electron T1 time, which is the time that the electrons in a hand wave kind of feeling have to move around and diffuse around and then interact with the nuclei to polarize the nuclei. So they get created underneath the magnetic mesa, but they can move outside from underneath the mesa and polarize nuclei further away. So once again, we're able to generate in this this manner effective fields up to about a tesla and 10 to the 4th to the 10 to the 5th teslas per meter gradients using this simple magnetic lithographic patterning. And it looks like electron spin diffusion probably is going to limit this minimum, limit the sharpness of the features and the minimum features that you can pattern this way. So finally, I want to talk about an all optical route to patterning inhomogeneous nuclear spin polarizations. And so the motivation behind this was, again, coming from this initial ferromagnetic imprinting paper where they showed that the Larmor frequency, which is, again, proportional to the nuclear spin polarization, depends strongly on the optical intensity that you're hitting the sample with. So for this manganese arsenide, gallium arsenide sample, you increase the pump intensity and you dramatically increase the nuclear spin polarization. And so the motivation was to see, because in this experiment they were using these 40 or 50 micron diameter beams, we thought maybe if we could repeat it and just look, probe in the center, maybe we would observe higher nuclear polarization. And maybe we can use this intensity dependence to all optically patterned laterally inhomogeneous nuclear polarizations. And I just want to note, in the previous lithographic patterning experiment, we also came upon this one instance of significantly higher nuclear polarization. So this is maybe 50% higher than we would generally see in the nuclear polarization. And it's a much sharper transition from the high nuclear polarization to the low polarization. And we don't know what this is, but we'd love to hear any ideas on how you could create something like this, because this resulted in much, much larger order of magnitude type larger gradient magnetic fields.
Under which conditions should be used?
So this was, we were just scanning under one of these magnetic mesas, and in the middle, roughly in the middle of one of them, instead of seeing this kind of flat background, we saw, you know, this one very large spike in the nuclear polarization, and it's confined much more tightly. And upon warming the sample and cooling down again, we could go back to the same place and see the same thing. So it was reproducible, but we couldn't see anything optically. It was some kind of mysterious defect that we would like to be able to reproduce if possible.
So you just saw it in one defect or in
that? This was one time only.
So you see anything that you said you couldn't see optically?
We looked at it with an
Gathering around
We didn't do a measurement that would be sensitive to that, but presumably that's something like that is going on. You have, you know, some electrostatic confinement in this lateral area, right? We didn't have a direct optical measurement of that, and we couldn't see anything, you know, with an optical microscope. But
so low temperature measurements.
Yes, I'm sorry. These measurements are all at low temperature because the nuclear polarization doesn't survive above about 60 Kelvin. So this was at 5 or 7 Kelvin. So here's the previous experiment once again, and in this experiment we have a continuous ferromagnetic film of manganese arsenide. We use a microscope again, and this time we focus the imprinting beam down to about 20 microns and just blast the gallium arsenide with above band gap light. And so we can see that just using this all optical technique, outside the imprinting beam we see the slow precession frequency, and inside we see the intensity dependent higher precession frequency. And we can do a 1D scan like this of the time-resolved Kerr signal, fit it, and you see something like this. But the interesting thing is that if you look at the profile of the excitation, which is shown in red here, this 20 micron wide roughly excitation, it's much narrower than the nuclear polarization for these conditions. So this is again low temperature, relatively high power, 0.2 Tesla applied field. We see that you see a much wider nuclear polarization profile, which again could be due to the electron spins, which are polarized by the FPP effect, diffusing around, and then subsequently polarizing the nuclei further away from where they're excited. And also, interestingly, you see that it's not, the nuclear polarization is not peaked in the center. It's actually, there's a decrease in the nuclear polarization. And if you image this, you know, do a nice big 2D image, and you see this sort of donut or volcano or torus type shape, and so we call these nuclear donuts for fun. We looked at the power and temperature dependence once again, and in the case of the power dependence, we see that this nuclear polarization turns on, and you know, right when it turns on, it's already a very wide profile, and it's, you know, that it's cut off in the middle. Basically, the nuclear polarization is lower than you might expect in the middle. Then you increase the power, increase it, and you get this nice donut shape and relatively 3/10, 4/10 of a Tesla effective nuclear magnetic field. And you increase it even further, and the depth of the dip in the middle increases, but so does the peak in this red curve here. So does the peak nuclear polarization, and you can plot these, you know, these peak values. You see this non-monotonic behavior versus excitation power, and the dip also. Temperature dependence follows sort of what you would intuitively expect. At lowest temperature, you have the highest nuclear polarization, and the nuclear polarization in general decreases as a function of temperature, but also the dip or hole in the center goes away as you increase the temperature.
Sorry, so the power dependence is not monotonic?
Exactly. So for 7.5 milliwatts, you see the highest peak in the nuclear polarization, and then at the highest power in this red curve, it's decreased. But the dip continues to increase, or at least not decrease as much as the peak did.
Can it be attributed to heating of electrons?
Yes, that's the obvious conclusion that I was going to come to next, but yes. Let me just go through this experiment real quick, where we tried to get a little bit more information on what's going on. And what we did is we separated the pump and the probe beams like this, instead of having them overlap, separated them by about 6 microns, either having the pump to the left or the pump to the right, and then we repeated with the pump overlapped, and then repeated this line scan across the imprinting beam. And so here's sort of some ugly raw data, but you can see that this curve rotation signal increases as a function of the pump probe delay as the spins that were created at the pump six microns away arrive at the probe spot in, a nanosecond or so. And if you look at this color intensity time resolved curve rotation data once again as a function of position, you see that in this case where the pump is on the left of the probe beam, if you focus on this highest nuclear polarization area here and here, we see that there's a noticeable asymmetry in the signal. And so when you're on the right of the donut and the pump and the probe are in this configuration, you see an enhancement in the signal here. So that basically tells you that something is pushing the pump spins towards the probe beam. Whereas on the other side, this is not true. So presumably on the left-hand side here, the pump-created spins are being pushed further away from the probe. And if you switch the direction of the pump, or switch the side of the pump and the probe, the opposite is true. And once again, with the overlapped case, you don't see this asymmetry. So this is basically telling us that something's driving these pump spins, or something's driving electron spins away from the center of the imprinting beam. And yeah, so the possible mechanisms, the most obvious mechanism almost certainly is that you're heating the sample, because we're focusing a fairly intense beam into a small area in the sample. And once again, this is electrical data which shows that as a function of temperature, the mobility increases, so the spins are more mobile. But I also point out that if you look at the T2 star time, the effective decoherence time for these precessing spins, it shows, that's in these black squares here, we see that there's a quite short T2 star time, which could also be due to heating and the inhomogeneous effective nuclear field that's around near the center of the donuts. Okay, so I'll skip the conclusions because I think we're running low in time. I can't be a lot more specific than that. The nuclear polarization is well known to has been shown to decrease in these similar systems by 50 or 60 Kelvin, and
it, you seem to say that the hydrophile coupling constant itself changed.
Oh, maybe that's, let's see. That's just a guess, and I don't have any evidence for that, I guess. So I wouldn't necessarily stand by that too strongly. But I guess, the nuclear polarization is decreasing as a function of temperature, so your depolarization processes could be increasing, or, the coupling between the electron and the nuclei could also be decreasing. And so there's been quite a bit of theoretical work done on these systems. I'm happy to have two of the theorists here today, Garrett Bauer and Lou Sham. This has generated quite a bit of interest, which I'm happy about. But we'd love to hear any other input that you might have, especially with regards to that hyperpolarization and the very high gradient field that we saw in that one defect case. Maybe we're forming some sort of quantum dot effectively in that defect, something like that. And we'd also like to get a more quantitative feel for what the electron spin polarization could be in the electrically biased samples. So if anybody has any thoughts on that, I'm happy to talk to you about that. So just in summary, this very simple material system composed of a semiconductor and a ferromagnetic metal, and you know, maybe with or without gates, ends up being a very rich environment for spins in the semiconductor. You have the interaction between the electron spins and the ferromagnet. You have the interactions between the electron spins and the nuclei. And then you have the back action of the nuclear spins on precessing electron spins. And so this is a very rich rich field to look for interesting physics in, I think. So do we have time to go on, or should I? Okay, I'll just fly through this really quickly. This is Martino Poggio's work, so it's I'll be brief. I wanted to just illustrate a couple of his experiments. Motivation behind these experiments that I'm going to talk about now came in a series of experiments done in our lab a number of years ago, where Jay Kakawa, John Solis, and others demonstrated this all-optical nuclear magnetic resonance technique. And here's just a scan of a Faraday rotation signal at a fixed time delay. So you're holding the pump and the probe fixed in time, and you're scanning the applied magnetic field. And what they saw is these, again, resonances which are related to nuclear polarization in the sample, which you can readily ascribe to the nuclear isotopes that are present. And so what Martino wanted to do, just quickly. So I've been talking about this scenario where you have nuclear spin polarization, which, you know, acts as an effective field on the electron, processing electrons. But in a similar manner, spin-polarized electrons, I don't know, I'm sorry, there's a timer on this. Spin-polarized electrons act as an effective field on the nuclear spins. And so what Martino wanted to do was to try to take this a step further and look for these all-optical NMR type effects in quantum structures and in confined, more highly confined structures on the nanometer scale. And see if he could manipulate the nuclear spins using the electron spins in this way. And specifically what he wanted to do was to translate in a quantum well the electron wave function spatially in a vertical manner to change the overlap, the spatial overlap in a localized manner with the nuclei that are also present in the quantum well. So in the previous experiments, I was looking at bulk-like 500 or 200 or 100 nanometer-like samples, and he's looking at quantum wells in this case. So in general, what he was doing, and I'll describe this more in a slide or two if I have time, is applying a gate voltage to move this electron wave function back and forth in a quantum well, and either holding the electrons, which can be spin polarized or not. If they are spin polarized, holding them there, which results in this dynamic nuclear polarization. And also, if you apply a time-varying electric field to jiggle these electron spins around, he wanted to see if you could affect resonantly the nuclear spins that way. So the way he did this was to look at a system composed of parabolic quantum wells. So this is a system where it's a gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide system, which has the appropriate aluminum grating that results in this parabolic potential in the conduction band. And so here's, you know, the potential here, and here's the wave function approximately. And you can easily show that just by applying an electric field to the system, you can shift this. You can shift the position of this wave function without distorting it at all because of the parabolic nature of the well. And he again used this time-resolved Faraday rotation technique. And in this case, because the electrons, he was moving the electrons in the well and therefore to an area with different aluminum content, he can't assume that the G factor is constant. And he instead used this fact to map out where he was moving the electron wave function to. So if you just look at the yellow here, he went to a known field, and he knows these other constants, and measured the Larmor precession frequency as a function of applied DC bias down here. And by using the G factor and the known dependence of the G factor on the aluminum concentration, he was able to determine that over this 3-volt range, he's able to shift the wave function something like 15 or 20 nanometers in the quantum well. And so once again, if you use spin-polarized electrons generated optically, and you let them sit at one location, they will tend to dynamically polarize the nuclei, and then you can map out this polarization as a function of position, vertical position in the quantum well, by changing the bias and using that known dependence on the G factor. And you can see that in these cases, this is a measure of Larmor precession frequency versus position, which again is proportional to the nuclear spin polarization. So we showed that by sitting the nuclear or the electron spin polarization generated optically, you can create these highly localized sort of pancakes of nuclear spin polarization. So this is on a 10 nanometer scale, and we see this, you know, noticeable change in the nuclear spin polarization. And so this is his cartoon picture of what's going on. You sit here, dynamically polarize the nuclei under these spin polarized electrons. Can move them, and then let these guys relax and move them back and measure them again and look at the time dependence and such. Maybe we're short for time, so I'm going to stop here and take your questions. Thanks.
I have a question to these nuclear donuts that you showed us. Mm-hmm. Are these all steady-state pictures? I mean, if you keep shining light on the sample while you measure them.
We looked at both, actually. But in general, the ones I showed were steady-state with the illumination on. But we looked at setting up the nuclear polarization, turning off the light, and looking at how it evolved. And it basically just fell monotonically with not huge variations in the time constant and function of position. There were some small changes, but...
Does it become bigger, or is it just staying there and fading away?
It basically stayed there and faded away. It didn't spread out further.
Experimental question, how did they take a fiber or something to measure the electron, the exciton? Microluminescence in that neighborhood.
That's a good question. I think there are definitely some technical advances that could be made in the system. The way it is now, it's difficult. There's very little space in between the injective and the cryostat window. What would be nice is to use the backside of the cryostat and have a similar type injective that you could use for a different type of experiment like that to collect the PL or something like that. The problem is the sample's not situated symmetrically in the cryostat, so it's pushed a little bit towards the front, and you'd need an even longer working distance microscope objective to be able to collect that light effectively, and those are kind of hard to come by, basically. But I think it's definitely possible, and it definitely would open up some further experiments to look at.
You're here for 6 weeks, right?
Do I get to play with the toys?
Yeah, I'm just curious. Has anybody ever seen these kinds of dynamic nuclear polarization effects in metals? And could you tomorrow say?
I'm not aware of that, but I honestly haven't looked in metallic systems at all. Could we tomorrow? I don't think so. But I'd have to think about more externally how you would access. David, do you have any insight on that?
How would you control the electrons and measure them?
You certainly could do dichroism, right? You can shine out polarized light to pump probe experiment? Would it be very, very different?
But I'm not sure how you would disentangle the effects from this continuous band of electrons in the middle.
Yeah, that's the main difference.
So unless you did some type of traditional NMR.
But I think in terms of nuclear polarization, I mean, it might be more of a mess and maybe pointless. But I'm just curious. I don't see why it wouldn't work. Why you couldn't polarize a nuclei.
Well, it does. That's what people do in the 60s. But if you're talking about control.
Right. I mean, you definitely would polarize a nuclei. But I'm not sure how you would do electrical control. For
they do it optically in the 60s?
No. Yes. But not on the electrons.
But yes,
Just electrons and resonance.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Double resonance
yeah.
done all the time, right?
Yeah.
That's the prime draw of the 60s.
Well, I was right.
I mean, the highest the polarization you showed was around 20%.
Or 40% in some way.
30, I believe. So.
Yeah. So, what limits that? I mean, I mean, I know of numbers in literature reported 60-70%.
Theorists.
I mean, there are experiments in physics group in the 80s and they.
I think it's just the rate question. You have these electrons, these optically excited carriers are still around, around the nuclear spin-polarized nuclei, and these other photoexcited carriers are able to interact also. So one experiment we looked at was to polarize the nuclei as much as we could, and just monitor how they depolarize by turning off the imprinting beam versus lattice ion, and then. We repeated the experiment, so we just had the pump and the probe continuously flashing the sample and monitoring the signal. And then we repeated the experiment to basically hold the sample in as dark conditions as we could. So we blocked the pump and the probe, we blocked the imprinting beam, we turned off the room lights, and you did see that the nuclear spin polarization fell more slowly, noticeably more slowly. So it is the photoexcited carriers that are driving the depolarization to some extent. So if you could create the nuclear polarization resonantly or something, and deplete all the carriers and only put in spin polarized carriers in the proper geometry, you could presumably polarize them further, but you have to continually be getting rid of the excess carriers.
So there's a clear experimental protocol for trying to do this, which is to generate nuclear polarization. In this case, it's set gate D that makes the system insulated immediately afterwards to try to remove the relaxation mechanism from the spin. And then these numbers should shoot up. I don't think the mechanisms would change, but you would remove a scattering channel for the nuclear spins. So doubling it, I don't really see a problem. Mm-hmm. I think numbers in the literature are reporting 100% nuclear polarization. The more part, I'd be interested in learning more about. But I don't see clear ways to do that.
I think there you're looking at more highly confined systems where the overlap is perfect, basically. And also, you're not able to see nuclear spin diffusion in quantum dot type structures.
Maybe other questions
we're talking. Yeah. Well, I was curious about this peak. Maybe this is related to the question of how to improve polarization. You have this very sharp peak that you.
Sure.
Are there any signatures what this could be? I mean, could this be from a nuclear spin from another species that you have there, or?
I just threw that up there. We didn't publish that because we didn't have a whole lot of insight. But my guess is it's. If I had to guess, I would say that some along the lines that Lucian was hinting at, that you're seeing some electrostatic confinement of excitons or electrons or whatever it may be.
Especially just a localized carrier.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that in effect is a quantum dot. Yeah, exactly. That formed by mistake during the growth.
But so what you're seeing is the nuclear polarization, or you see electronic spin polarization?
In that measurement, we only looked at the nuclear polarization.
The other issue I think that is interesting to ponder that came out of Jason's work is that when you looked at those experiments looking at the effects of nuclear and electron polarization, maybe the edge of these microfabricated samples, you see these relatively large effects, which some of which can be due to strain. And we think that plays a role in, say, other experiments that look at spin Hall physics. where when you go any type of string near the edge, you can generate these artifacts which have which are just string dependent and nothing to do with spin at all physics. So I think, as Jason alluded to, it's very important to precisely characterize these types of electronic interactions in small systems.
I think ideally it'd be nice to get a map of the electron and nuclear spin polarizations, which, you know, if we warm up and cool down the sample and go to exactly the same conditions, we generally see for the same MESA similar qualitative maps of the nuclear polarization. But it would be nice to be able to, you know, have a 100% perfect feeling for what the interface is like in those structures, but we of course can't do that without damaging the sample.
Paul Crowell and collaborators have reproduced your spin accumulations at the drains, but they were puzzled by the sign of the polarization because it was not consistent with the simple two-channel model. So my question is the sign they measure the same which you measure for the same sample system, which will be gallium arsenide iron or not?
I'm not sure. I haven't gone through in detail there all the signs in their work.
They had a little bit simpler because they observed on the same sample the source polarization and the drain polarization, so they simply could compare things. And
I mean, like, if I had to guess, I would say I would just expect it to be the same signs and the same materials. I don't know.
I think for a lot of their analysis, they're assuming that too. Because what follows that is to use Jason's microscope and also his handy little technique to take the same sample with iron. Most of this work is manganese arsenide. They did it with iron on gallium arsenide.
And you did it also on iron, right, or not? Or
yeah, now? Some. Most of this is manganese arsenide.
Spin accumulation was on manganese arsenide.
Right.
Yes, but you didn't try to do this also on iron?
Not the spin accumulation.
Not at all. Okay.
Right.
So, but you have no problem with iron and manganese arsenide?
Now this is also a subtle point, I guess, which is not so easy. I think band structure calculations give different results depending on the interface morphology.
Simple changes in the solar barriers and density can get you changes, and that's what our previous calculations show. It's very rough theory. So there is nothing that says that if you believe in the scattering mechanism, there's nothing.
But it depends very strongly. I think it depends very strongly on details. For example, if you have a rough interface or you have a clean interface, this can change the sign at the same energy. According to the theory.
Sure, whatever. But with the experiments, I mean, it's actually easy to make a bad interface. So, I mean, I should explain for you, but one of the things that we did was ask people to make bad interfaces, which is easier than good interfaces, although harder to get in an odd way. Anyway, so the Jason did measurements on bad and good interfaces, and what we found is the sign issues were not changed at all, but the amplitudes of the effects changed. So with a bad interface, the signals were smaller, but the behaves phenomenologically exactly the same, the signs were the same. But the amplitudes changed.
Yes. And also, I guess, what in these theories is probably a completely ballistic interface is something which will never be reached by experiments anyway.
Never is a strong word, but...
right. But, okay, but still, I think it was interesting, and whether we can explain that or not, but you did not do any experiments, so... on this iron system for the accumulation.
Not to the accumulation.
And the reason that Paul did is because they spent they made such excellent progress in the last few years to make beautiful iron gallium arsenide interfaces for these spin LED structures. For dual purpose measurements, one for spin injection, the other was actually the spin injection.
Do we mean, I get it, do we mean exactly ballistic interfaces or specular? What is the problem?
It's not a problem.
It's speculative. I understand. To get speculative reflection,
right. That's
a problem. And what is this ballistic interfaces?
I mean, this is the same.
Ah, that's terminology.
That's just semantics.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
So I have a question, did you talk about coherent manipulation, let's say, of a spin coherence between the electron and the nuclear spin system? Is that possible to monitor how this, for example, goes back and forth, and that would possibly use the nuclear spins as a for storage of coherent manipulation?
Well, I think that was more, the first part of your question was more on Martino's work that I didn't have time to get to. So he showed that you could coherently depolarize the nuclei.
So coherently, that means that you can watch them go back and forth.
One direction, coherently, not the reverse. Yeah, because part of the physics that came out of Martino's measurement was a real surprise that actually the depolarization mechanism charges much bigger effect than spin. So when he did these high frequency AC measurements, where we expected the spin-spin interaction to dominate the physics, in fact, what was surprised is that unpolarized spin systems were very effective in operating the nuclei, which we're surprised how much the theory community seems to ignore. But it's a huge effect, and that was the main result, actually, of this Mizrach letter, that when you look at the magnetic dipole, electron dipole fields, actually oscillating a charge in the nuclear spin is very effective at moving the nuclei. And the spin-spin exchange between the electrons and the nuclei is remarkably weak. So while it does work, it's always going to be a problem in moving information back and forth. Or, as we experimentalists like to say, an opportunity.
Okay, and no more questions, then let's thank you, Steve. Thank you.